This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I'm good.
It would be up to me, wouldn't it?
Here we go, bro.
Hi, Fratelloni's Ace Hardware and Garden Stores brings you podcast, GL Podcast, number 146 already. 146. That's April 25th, 2019. 84 degrees back in 1962 on this day, and 25 degrees back in 1875. And our friends at Aquaside, they keep your beach free of weeds, bring you these lake ice out dates. White Bear, 1940, 1962, 1972. Hmm. You know what you can do? Minnetonka, 1888. Like White Bear, 1940. And Like White Bear, 1962.
And now, from the mayor's office, above the boathouse, on the east shore of Spoon Lake, it's Garage Logic, with Rookie on production, Chris Reavers, director of social media, John Hyde in the newsroom, and occasionally Kenny from the Krabby Coffee Shop. Here is your flashlight king, fireworks commissioner, and keeper of common sense, your mayor, Joe Souchere.
You know, pretty soon you're not going to have these lake ice out dates to kick around.
Well, it's kind of like Dick Nixon, huh?
We're running out of them. There'll be a few left. There's a few in May, but we're nearing the end.
Oh,
we're nearing the end.
So tragic.
And that's why you need to get a hold of Aquaside, by the way.
Hell yeah.
They sell these pellets that kill all the weeds in the lake. You can't beat it. It's safe, DNR, EPA approved. They've been killing weeds and making your lake shore safe for swimming and comfortable for swimming for more than 60 years. Those pellets are easy to use and begin working right away. Don't let weeds take over the lake,
right?
Because then, you know, you got a lot of problems.
Yeah, but think about that. When you're walking down to the beach, you want to see some nice sand.
You want to see sand.
You don't want to see weeds.
You know what? You want to see the sand underwater the color of gin. Gin-colored water. That's how I think of a clear lake.
Now you're making me thirsty.
And I don't drink gin, by the way, so I'm not trying
really?
To attach.
That's
I don't.
Interesting. You want it to look like gin.
Yeah. Call Aquaside at 1-800-328-9350. That's 1-800-328-9350, or go to aquaside.com.
With a little slice of lime, right?
Yeah,
right?
I'd be lapping up that lake water.
Lake Superior always looks gin colored to me. Just gin clear, you know. Say, this
is it's salt water.
This is the toughest show of the week to put together. Positive Thursday. But it's very positive that New York Times bestselling author John Camp will be with us.
I'm happy. I always like to see him. He's a great guy.
You know, one of Camp's kids runs his social media world. We got to have him tell the people that he's going to be interviewed on.
The last time he was on, because was he the first podcast guest?
Yes.
He was one of the first podcast guests.
Do we want to remember that first podcast?
No, he wasn't on the first podcast.
Okay, one of.
But he was one of our first guests, and they did put it up on their on John's Facebook page.
The new book is Neon Prey. He'll be joining us later on in the show. Positive Thursday. Pilots persuade Navy not to dismiss UFO reports. I think that's positive. Well, in other words, the pilots have been in fear of recriminations in their career if they come back to base and say, you know, I saw another one. They feared getting a reputation as being goofy. But these are, you know, college graduates and engineers, some of these top-notch Navy pilots. And there's been a recent uptick in sightings of unidentified flying objects. This is according to the Washington Post. This isn't a black helicopter report. Since 2014, these intrusions have been happening on a regular basis. Joseph Gradisher, a spokesman for the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Warfare, told the Washington Post. Recently, unidentified aircraft entered military-designated airspace as often as multiple times per month. Mm. We want to get to the bottom of this. We need to determine who's doing it, where it's coming from, and what their intent is. We need to try to find ways to prevent this from happening again. Citing safety and security concerns, Gradisher vowed to investigate each and every report. Luis Elizondo, a former senior intelligence officer, said that the new Navy guidelines formalize formalizes the reporting process, facilitating data-driven analysis while removing the stigma from talking about UFOs, calling it the single greatest decision the Navy has made in decades. In other words, they're going to take this seriously.
Yeah.
Chris Mellon, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence and a staffer on the Senate Intelligence Committee, was less laudatory. "I don't believe in safety through ignorance," he said, scolding the intelligence community for its lack of curiosity and courage and failure to react. "In some cases, pilots, many of whom are engineers and academy graduates, say they have observed small spherical objects flying in formation. Others say they've seen white tic-tac-shaped vehicles. Aside from drones, all engines rely on burning fuel to generate power, but these vehicles all had no air intake, no wind, and no exhaust. It's very mysterious, and they still seem to exceed our aircraft in speed," he said, calling it a truly radical technology. Now we're going to, the Navy's going to say, "Rook, you just got in from a flight.
Yep.
You saw something?"
Yeah, I saw a flying saucer that did not leave any exhaust, and I couldn't see what was inside because it left so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Am I nuts?
I heard tic-tac shaped.
Yeah.
So it's
little, what, little
things,
oblong
tic-tacs that fly on their side.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand it's positive that we're not going to...
Well, it's very positive.
We're not going to attach a negative connotation to these pilots that are coming back saying, "Hey, we trust what you saw with your own eyes," but
I would trust
that spook us a little bit?
I would trust a Navy pilot more than I would trust a drunk fisherman.
Sure.
Okay, yes.
That got me. I was on the end of the... That's the famous story about the two guys on a pier in Pascagoula, Mississippi back in the 70s. Claimed they were visited, taken into the ship, put back on land. Nobody ever believed them, but...
Well, here's what... This makes me wonder...
Very positive, though.
How many times this has happened and the pilots were too sheepish.
Many.
And what did they see?
That's the positivity of this, is that they're no longer going to fear for any career dismissals or degradings.
Let's do an calling all units. Come back and report to us if you think you saw something.
No, you know what it is, man? There's a lot going on out there.
Do you really think there's a flying saucer out there?
I have no idea. These were described as tic-tacs.
And how could they outrun us without any fuel or emission discharge?
Well, if you would have listened to the story I just read,
yeah, I was there.
They're acknowledging the existence of a technology they're unfamiliar with.
Damn.
Mm-hmm.
So once we learn how to do that, we're sitting on Manitou Island.
Have to change the oil, every
maybe
so many thousand miles.
I bet there's no oil involved. I hope.
How you doing?
Why is your toot on? Will you get rid of that? Sorry, we're just doing a little inside radio where one of his. There you go. Perfect. A blinking light was driving me nuts.
Well, why is there's no volume here? There's no volume on my board.
Oh, here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Here we go.
That's what it was on. It was on that.
Thank you very much. Do you guys have audio challenges for me today so that I might turn what you think will trap me into something positive?
I do, and I don't know that you've commented on this subject. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe you have lightly, but I heard just a snippet from the Governor Walz.
Would you like to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first if I'm allowed
you
to.
You may.
And he was announcing his 2-year budget.
All right.
Which, of course, I'm not going to talk the money because, yes, they wanted more money for education. They always do.
Right.
But it was the same old stuff that we've heard from every governor. Governor Dayton did the same thing. Now it's transferred to Governor Walz.
I see.
And I really do want you to find out, to challenge you, how you can turn this these words into something positive.
All right.
Okay, here we go.
Is it long?
No, it's not very long.
All right.
It's clear to me that there's three top priorities for the people of Minnesota.
Okay, listen.
Education, health care, and community prosperity. Minnesotans want to bring down the cost of health care, provide a quality education to their children and grandchildren, ensure that communities across this state are prospering.
All right. It's just that quick. Community prosperity.
It's easy.
No, it's not.
To make that positive?
What is community prosperity is like the kids that take a class and they, how do you feel? You can't fail it. What type of money can be thrown at community prosperity?
I don't intend for you to box me in any way. When I'm challenged to find the positivity, it might come from a completely different direction than you expect.
Okay,
this is
ahead.
Easy for me.
I'm throwing you a bone by leaving out healthcare and leaving out education because those are constantly we talk about
you
those.
You want to know what the positivity of this is?
Yeah, what is community?
Once the people get hit with a gas tax, if he succeeds in getting it through, mm-hmm. the people affected the most are the people who can least afford it, and they will begin to further understand that the left is not the way they should be voting.
I'll take that. I thought it would be. I thought you'd be a little more tapped.
People,
a little more.
People are going to become a little more alert to the idea that he is typical of all liberal politicians with his gibberish.
So basic.
And his policies are going to be seen as more harmful to the people on a lower socioeconomic rung than they are for anyone else, and he will be seen to be. The lefty that he is.
Okay, so basically what your positive spin is on the health care, education, and community prosperity, you're saying, bring it on. Bring it on. It's right. Okay, it's, Governor. We'll see what happens.
Well, because it's all meaningless. It's all meaningless.
I saw something yesterday, too. Our guy, Senator Jasinski, posted something online about the gas tax, and I think it was a CARE 11 piece that he cited where if the gas tax doesn't get enacted, if it gets shot down, that there's thought they might go to a mileage tax.
Mm-hmm.
Are these people that stupid?
This is Positive Thursday.
It is Positive
right,
Thursday,
hang
but,
out. Reeves,
but there's no chance that any of this is going to happen. You would cripple families.
Why is there no chance?
Well, I guess I shouldn't even say that. Yeah. But that's the way that these people think. It's laughable.
All right, there's a challenge left from Reavers that'll have to come later. Rookie, you've been defeated.
Thanks, I guess.
Okay. An Australian vegan feminist cafe is closing after opening in 2017 with much fanfare. The cafe was called Handsome Her. It declared that upon opening, it would charge male patrons 18% more than they would charge women for the exact same service. A gender tax designed to get people talking about the wage gap. The tax, according to NPR, was optional. Three hard and fast rules of the cafe were women have priority seating, men will be charged an 18% premium to reflect the gender pay gap, which is donated to a woman's service, and respect goes both ways. And then they promptly went out of business because they weren't making any money.
Okay.
Which I think is terribly positive.
Okay.
I'm also glad that today's a day where Kenny's not here because he would have come up with a name for the vegan restaurant.
It already has a name.
I meant
Handsome Her. So I think it's very positive to realize that these goofballs were trapped by reality.
Okay. Yep.
Caused reality set in, and Handsome Her is no longer going to serve up its... vegetarian dishes.
It's. I guess another positive spin would be the public has spoken.
Or you know what else is positive? Joe, where did this take place? Where was the vegan restaurant?
This was Australia.
Or the fact that they weren't bailed out by the government to keep them open.
That's a very good point. All right, we're going to take a break. Remember, John Camp will be joining us today.
Have you noticed the consolidation happening to commercial insurance agencies today? This is Patrick Ricey for the Canopy Group. The big just keep getting bigger, and you and your business continue to get passed around until you become a dreaded house account. You have been consolidated. All of this was done to you without your control. Get options and take control of your company's insurance program. Have the Canopy Group help you gain a commercial insurance strategy that makes your business more attractive to the insurance industry. The more insurance companies that we can get interested in your business, the more competitive your pricing will be. If your business is renewing in March, April, or May and is paying less than $80,000 in premium, don't accept being a house account. Get the attention you deserve with the Canopy Group. Visit thecanopygroup.com or call 800-967-3389. 800-967-3389. The Canopy Group.
The Earth is not your mother. The Joe Soucheray Show.
Take that down.
Huh?
Take that orchestra down. I don't know why. Was it Chief Offsite Correspondent Kelsey was among the emailers who wanted me to be aware of the Farmington story?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was a great story.
Yeah, but it's about 2 weeks old.
Well, it's still
positive.
We're
on the cutting edge here. It's got to be today or nothing.
We're done with that one.
No, four positive Thursday. Many emailers, including the Chief Offsite Correspondent, wanted me to be aware that the, I believe it was the robotics team, at Farmington High School.
These are straight GL kids.
Absolutely.
Right here.
Yeah. Built a power wheelchair for 2-year-old Cillian Jackson. And because they're very expensive and the parents needed this help, and the robotics team at Farmington hand built a power wheelchair from a Power Wheels riding toy.
That is
the coolest. I saw this on the news. I think it was one of those Boyd Huppert pieces, maybe.
Yeah, I think it was, too.
I saw this. These kids took time out of their busy schedules to do this for our son, said Cillian's mom, Chrissy Jackson. We're so grateful. Cillian was born with a genetic condition that makes mobility difficult. He has an especially hard time controlling his body. He has a lot of symptoms you'd see in someone who has cerebral palsy, said Tyler Jackson, Cillian's dad. So Tyler reached out to the robotics team at his former high school after he realized an actual power wheelchair would be cost prohibitive for his family and unlikely to be covered by insurance due to Cillian's young age. Can you foghorn this kid? I'm sorry. I love him.
You're going to foghorn him?
You know, I mean, come on, Cillian? What is that? I love him, and I'm happy that this is all working out.
Foghorn
this kid. I just foghorned this kid. Cillian, I love you, but, you know, I don't know what they were thinking when they named you Cillian. Farmington robotics coach Spencer Elvback says there was no hesitation by his students. I brought it up to the kids, and they said, is this something we want to step up and do? And he said there was a unanimous yes. So the members of the robotics team replaced nearly every electrical component in the Power Wheels toy, mounted a seat from a bicycle carrier, and designed a joystick to fit Cillian's needs, and then that the students fabricated on a 3D printer. Along the way, they sought technical assistance from Go Baby Go, a program at the University of Delaware that helps give mobility to children with disability. But mostly, the Farmington kids relied on skills they learned building their competition robots. Instead of completing a task, we're helping change someone else's life, team member Drew Eisenzimmer said. Cillian took to his ride immediately. Isn't that great?
It is. I've been to these robotics competitions.
Mm-hmm.
Gabe's on a robotics team. And what they love most to do is solve problems.
Yeah.
It's really not about winning and grabbing the balls. It's they want to solve problems. And this is just a fantastic.
You know what the power wheelchair would have cost the parents of Cillian?
I saw this, yes.
More than 20 grand.
Yeah.
More than 20 grand.
And these kids went and solved it for, $1,000 maybe in parts and whatnot?
I have not. They didn't charge anybody.
I guess whatever it cost the school for the supplies to put it together is, I guess, what I meant. That is so cool. That is so cool.
That's very good. That's very positive. And I'm just kidding, Cillian, when I foghorn your name, but that's part of the show.
It's GL.
It's GL.
I wonder if the Farmington Robotics team will adopt this young one. And as he ages.
Kind of the team mascot?
Yeah. Well, or 4 years down the road when he's six and this doesn't, you can't use this anymore.
Oh, that's true, because he's going to outgrow it.
Go back to the robotics team and give it a go.
Well, just a fantastic.
The three of us, how long would it take for us to put together the old robotic wheelchair?
You put me in a room.
Yep.
With all of the equipment.
I got everything for you. It's all.
That these kids utilized.
Yep.
And you tell me, why don't you bring, why don't you create a robotic wheelchair, create a wheelchair for our young friend here,
Cillian.
And
all the tools.
And you could come back in, 50 years, there'd just be a skeleton there.
Sitting in the corner, curled up
with a piece of wire in my hand.
This is what he was going to start with. This is
step one.
Right.
Say Mother's Day is coming up. Why don't you get mom or your wife or, you know, your loved ones something that lasts longer than flowers or a brunch? And R.F. Moeller Jeweler is there to help you. They were founded 68 years ago by Bob Moeller at the corner of Cleveland and Ford Parkway in St. Paul. They created a foundation of service that they've not only acknowledged but embraced. They have the Goldsmiths. They specialize in repairing and restoring heirlooms. Every piece you take in for repair is inspected four different times, and your jewelry, this is key, your stuff, your precious stuff, your heirlooms, never leave the store. I also have the Rolex-trained watchmakers, full-time appraisers. And you go in there, and you mention you heard Moeller on the GL podcast, and they will replace your watch battery at no charge while you oogle and ogle all the stuff on the display cases.
I got an email, a text from Bobby Moeller. He says, we can do fobs.
Well, I know they do.
Ah, that's what I'm telling you. Just as an added bonus, we need your fob
but
done.
But it's the watch battery they get that'll be free.
Right, right. But they'll do the fobs. They might charge you a little something.
R.F. Moeller Jeweler is at 50th and France in Edina, Ford in Cleveland in St. Paul, Gavaday Common in downtown Minneapolis, or online at rfmoeller.com. That's M-O-E-L-L-E-R. rfmoeller.com. It's absolutely the best jewelry stores in the business. I've been dealing there and knowing these people for the last 30 years. What do you...
Yeah, I've been there too, and I've got watches. They've fixed rings. They've got all sorts of great
stuff. Go get our guest, and when we return, we have Author's Corner with John Camp.
Wow, I would rather hear that.
I want to hear... Hey, do your mic check for us on the air. Do your mic check that you just did.
What, singing that song?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It's a long day living in Reseda. There's a freeway running through the yard. She's a good girl. She don't even miss
It's time for Author's Corner. Now, here's Joe Souchere.
That's the best mic check we've ever had.
For sure.
John.
Sit right down for Author's Corner. Oh, let's all have some fun. Listen up to Souchere, because before you know it, it's done. It's time for Author's Corner with Joe Souchere, and this one is a strike.
This is it. Okay, this is the last
Joe
one.
Souchere, just the way you want
Where's
it.
The one with the gear?
Author's Corner.
You're downshifting.
Style. Who will it be next?
Say, John.
Yeah.
You're in town for... Will you stop playing these?
Okay.
You're in town for Neon Prey, the 29th. You ever think you'd get to 29?
I never thought I'd get to 5. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I was talking about doing 5 and retiring, and now I'm at 29. I'll do 30 starting in June. And next year, I'm only going to do one book. I'm going to put Virgil Flowers and Davenport in the same book for 1 year, and I may not do 2 books a year anymore.
Might you ever stop completely?
I don't know about that.
Why would you? I guess I would wonder.
Well, that's the same reason you haven't stopped.
Right.
And it's because of what we do.
Yeah.
So
Neon Prey, you increasingly get Lucas. He seems to me to be increasingly gone from home longer and longer periods.
Yeah. And I just kind of wanted to get him out in the country a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, in various tax-deductible places like, you know, Las Vegas.
Los that you Angeles have to check
and,
out.
And Miami and,
right.
and you know, Washington, D.C., where I have to do research.
Right. And one thing I've always meant to ask you is the success has already been clearly established. These tend to go right to the New York Times bestseller list. Do you find yourself taking liberties now that you wouldn't have dared taken on book 3?
Yeah. I no longer am afraid to describe places like they are instead of being nice about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to be nice. I describe in the current Virgil book I'm looking, I describe a Twin Cities bar as looking like a Marseille whorehouse.
Right.
In the way it's decorated. And I probably wouldn't have done that in book 3.
Do you name the actual bar?
Yes.
Okay. And so you would not have done that?
No.
What about writing liberties? In terms of sentence structure and dialogue, and
I think that I might be too slick now.
Well,
I'm starting to remind myself of your column, actually.
Oh, thanks a lot.
you're welcome. Bam! Shot the goal.
Well, many emailers have wanted me to ask you this. This is from Bert. I got hooked on Sanford at Shadow Prey. I have what may be an obvious question. Two of the things I enjoy about Sanford's writing are his briskness and economy. Does this attribute stem from your background as a newspaper man?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And
you were the world's worst newspaper columnist.
No,
but probably one of the great reporters.
Pulitzer, no, he had one. He had one where he got the whole award.
He's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter.
He got one.
There's a guy in Britain that I really like, actually in Ireland, I'm sorry. I apologize to all Irish people.
What's his name?
John Connolly.
Okay.
And he writes very elaborate scenes. He can go on for five pages about what things look like, and he's just terrific.
But you told me to never do that.
I know, but I mean, some people do it, and I don't. Mm-hmm. And he does it very well. And I really enjoy his book, but I can't do what he does.
Are you increasingly using more and more dialogue?
It's almost all dialogue now, it seems. I actually have to go back and edit the book to put in, establishing scenes, what people look like and that places look like a Marseille whorehouse, which I've never been in, by the way.
You've read a lot of Elmore Leonard, I bet.
Yeah.
Well, towards the end, it was purely 100% dialogue.
Well, Elmore also wrote screenplays.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that's where some of the training comes from.
Yeah. Say, I think you take liberty, and I enjoy it, but, you know, we're old enough to remember. You have two cronies of Lucas, and they appear again in this book, Bob and Ray.
Right.
Well, Ray is R-A-E, is a female, but you're playing off the old radio team of Bob and Ray.
Right, and I also have another couple, Jenkins and Shrake, who Bob and Ray sort of replace in a way, but Jenkins and Shrake are Dan Jenkins and Bud Shrake, the sports writers from...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're sports writers from Sports Illustrated.
Well, I knew Jenkins. I knew Jenkins. I didn't know Shrake.
Yeah.
And Bob and Ray were a great radio comedy team on the radio. I think it was called Monitor. The show was called Monitor. And you could hear it on weekends if you were driving around with a parent. They'd invariably have it on the radio.
Of course.
Right. And they were just these crazy guys who would talk about really mundane subjects and somehow it was all really funny.
Ray Elliott and Bob Goulding.
Yep.
And isn't one of their kids now?
Elliott. Chris Elliott.
Chris Elliott.
He rose to fame with David Letterman, and he does something about Mary. Pretty funny guy.
What's with the gruesomeness of this tale? You have really created a bad guy in this situation.
Well, you know, the thing is that I was reviewed in the New York Times this weekend, and the woman who reviewed it in the book review said that she's down with cannibalism, but she doesn't like snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly my attitude. The thing is that I decided to have a bad guy who was a cannibal.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want him to be like Hannibal Lecter. I didn't want him to be like Hannibal the Cannibal, where some guy kind of drools all over, you know, the idea of eating people really turns him on. This guy is more like a barbecue chef, mm-hmm. you know, and he doesn't – it's not so much that he really wants to eat people. It's just that because he's a killer, he's got this meat available, and, you know, why go to waste?
Maybe Rook will read this one.
Yeah, it's food-based. Food-based. You have my attention here, Mr. Cannibal.
Well, I will tell you, if you look at the first page of the book – the barbecue recipe is guaranteed by a Tifton, Georgia barbecue judge.
Okay.
Right down to the last little kind of sprinkles and stuff you put on the meat before it comes off
God,
the grill.
God, you're a sick human being.
But I might use a different meat. I might use a different carcass, I think.
Well, that would be good if you don't have a dead woman available.
Yes.
You
know, it's
Bob and Ray are with what federal authority?
They're all with the U.S. Marshal Service.
U.S. Marshal, and that's what Lucas is now, is
U.S. Marshal Service.
Okay, when did Bob and Ray first appear? Was it Extreme Prey?
Yeah, it was about two or three books back. I can't remember the names anymore. I'm too old. but the thing is that I just want to say, as kind of an advertisement for the Marshal Service,
mm-hmm.
those SOBs did not give me 2 minutes to talk on the telephone.
Really?
I called up their PR department. It was like, you know, we got press releases to put out here, pal. You know, we don't have time to talk to you.
Yeah.
And I would say, all I want to know, what kind of guns do they have?
Right.
We're really in a rush here, okay?
Yeah.
And I used to work, you know, for two big newspapers, the Miami Herald and the Pioneer Press. And you know what we did with press releases from the Marshal Service? We played basketball with them.
Right.
You know, you wrinkle them up and see who can hit the basket up by the copy editor's desk. know, so that's what they were doing. At any rate, I'm a little unhappy with the Marshal Service, but that's where I am right now.
Did you ever get any information out of
them? No. You know, well, that's not entirely true because a U.S. Marshal came to one of my book signings and mm-hmm. gave me some information.
Oh, okay.
So, and then I looked up some stuff on the internet, but there's the Marshal Service is an extremely interesting service.
Mm-hmm.
Not the PR department, but the rest of the service mm-hmm. is very interesting.
Well, they don't have much. They don't have many boundaries, do they?
No, they have no boundaries. They have the widest jurisdiction of any U.S. law enforcement agency. Mm-hmm. Although, in reality, that they primarily work for the courts.
Does Lucas enjoy this more than he did working for the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension?
It said that Lucas likes it because it's like the next thing to being a bounty hunter.
Right.
You know, he only has to do what he wants, and being a bounty hunter would be better, except it'd be really expensive.
He likes the action, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. What last night you were – it's too late to advertise. Last night you were at Once Upon a Crime. Tonight, April 25th, this will be posted in time for people to know this. You'll be at Barnes & Noble in Edina.
Yes.
At the Galleria.
And on Friday night, I'll be out at the Barnes & Noble up in Roseville.
Roseville. When did you get in town?
Yesterday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, actually.
When do you leave? Saturday morning?
Saturday morning at the crack of dawn.
Where do you head?
Back home. This is the shortest tour I've ever done.
You're just doing the Twin Cities?
That's right. Well, I my first stop was in Phoenix, in Scottsdale.
Okay.
And then I flew here and... going home on Saturday.
And home is now Santa Fe.
Yes.
And that probably will end up being Santa Fe. You've moved around a bit, but you seem infatuated with Santa Fe.
Well, you know, Santa Fe is an extraordinarily interesting place. It's not warm like most people think it is. It's, mm-hmm. The temperatures are sort of like here until you get to the first week in December. Mm-hmm. Then you get colder. Mm-hmm. And we tend to stay, our highs most of the year are in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But the all-time record low there is minus 22. So it gets cold.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't have winters like you guys had this year.
No.
This year, it's still going on, I think.
Doesn't snow in April there?
Yes.
It does?
It snows in May sometimes. Our house is at 7,500 feet.
So you're up, elevated. Okay. Got it.
They were skiing there until 2 weeks ago.
Well, now we have a place to go when we go out there, Joe.
Hell, he's got
a place to stay.
He's got a guest house bigger than our house.
That's fine. The Mikulskis will feel very comfortable over there.
John, why neon pre? I think it's the coolest cover of the series, by the way.
Well, it's because of all the neon in,
right.
Well, Las Vegas.
They've
got this neon in Las Vegas.
I get that.
But it's true.
It is very showy. It is very showy.
But it's like our recording light when it's on, that thing on the right of neon, to the right of neon. You name them all, correct?
No, I don't name any of them.
You don't?
No.
Did you? You must have gone the first one.
The Virgil book this fall. No. The first one was named by some kind of title consultant in New Jersey.
Really?
I swear to God, yeah. The next
See,
Virgil
I'm learning
book
something every day.
Yeah. The next Virgil book is going to be called Bloody Genius, and I actually named that one.
Okay.
It's about a murder at the University of Minnesota.
All right. And Virgil is about to become a father.
Yes. Well, he won't in this book.
No.
But I thought... Well, I'm holding on for another book.
What do you think of our studio here?
It's pretty cool. This is better than the place you used to broadcast on the radio.
Absolutely.
It really is.
This is state-of-the-art Podcastville, man.
You know, I really think I'm not a writer, but I think we could...
Really?
We could really get together, do something together. It's food-based. Maybe a mad... A salad scare, and it could be lettuce spray.
Right, lettuce spray. I've heard that about 8,000 times.
Are you serious? I'm not that unique?
You're not, actually. Let me suggest something for you.
Yeah.
You've got all these guys now who are dead writers, like Tom Clancy, who are still publishing books.
Right.
That goes on for like 50 years, like Robert Flynn, Parker, Vince Flynn, all these kind of stuff. If Ricey died... That voice you were doing out there in the hallway, you could do Ricey for the 20 years.
Yes, Johnny Camp, hey, how you doing? I haven't been seen you since Spider Prince days, 88.
Well, John and Pat know each other well because they worked at the Pioneer Press for years together.
Well, and I think in this new book, you might find a
You're not
a
writing a
slice.
Book, all right?
No. In his new book, Neon Prey, you might find a slice of Minnesota.
Well, actually, it's going to be in the next Virgil book. I mentioned Fulda.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, there's a just in passing, there's a group marriage in Fulda in which 7 people get married to each other, and then they take a nude picture and send it to the New York Times Vows page, where it runs in all its glory. with little black rectangles over the bad picture. I'm kind of thinking it's sort of like you know, one of those Dumbo movies where the hippopotamuses dance. And so that was a picture I had in mind for that.
Where can you take Lucas? You say you're going to do number 30.
I'm going to go to Miami, I think.
Okay.
And because I spent a lot of time down there when I was, you know, younger.
Right.
And 8 years at the Miami Herald, which now is a newspaper about the size of, you know, the average shopper.
And well, join the club. We're all going down that road.
Yeah. But at the time, it was a glorious place to work. And I really liked Miami, and there was a lot of stuff going on.
You want to tell the story of the most difficult thing you ever reported on was in Miami, the airline crash?
Well, an L-1011 airline crashed in the Everglades, and I was talking to somebody about this the other night. They flew me out there in a helicopter, and so I spent the day watching them drag headless, armless bodies out of the water in the Everglades, and, you know, in the occasional head and the arm and stuff like that. And I was wondering if that had some kind of a shock effect on me, because I've never really been bothered by blood since then.
I'm wondering if it had something to do with your ability to create these gruesome scenes in the books.
And we talked about that as well, that I think it might have, because after you've seen all this dismemberment and stuff like that from an airline crash, I mean, it was awful.
And no one survived that, right?
Oh, yeah. Half the plane survived.
Oh, really?
It was really interesting, because what happened was that the wheels, apparently, they weren't sure that they were locked, and they were circling over the Everglades. And the Everglades are absolutely flat. They're like a runway.
Right.
And they're water. And they came down, and they didn't crash. Everybody went down the basement to see why the wheels weren't coming down. Mm-hmm. And the last words, I think, in the cockpit were, "Are we still at 1,100?
Mm-hmm.
And then they hit the water.
Oh, my God.
And they skidded for a huge distance. And then the plane broke in half. If it hadn't broken in half, they might all have lived.
Really?
It might have been like that landing on the Hudson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. I didn't know that half that. When was that? In the 70s, right?
Yeah. Probably about 74, maybe. Yeah. 73, 74.
And what were you tasked with? Writing a series or just writing, reporting?
Well, this was breaking news reporting.
I had a radio with me, and I was talking to the city desk.
Okay.
And you know, there was a guy there, a rewrite guy there, who was standing there taking everything that was coming in on it and rewriting it and putting it into one story.
Oh, my.
That's when newspapers were imperative in our lives.
Yep.
And how many people would have been in that newsroom on that day?
Oh, boy.
At the Miami Herald.
At the peak of the Miami Herald, hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah, a couple hundred at least. Yeah. And the thing is, we did a really good job covering it, and we did a really good job covering all that kind of stuff. Mm. And it was just a pretty amazing day. And I saw a lot of really disgusting stuff there, which I have to say fed into the book. And then so then people say, "Do you think you were psychologically damaged by that?" Well, I don't know. I might have been. Who knows? You know, I don't feel it, but you don't. It's not stuff that you see every day. That's for sure.
Do you still keep in touch with Carl Hiaasen?
Every once in a while, and I mean, you know, I know some stuff about the things that are going on in his life, and like the fact that we both have sick dogs right now. I have a dog that's got cancer, and Carl's got a dog that he's either lost or is losing, and so you know, we've both got the same agent, and so. And we've always been very friendly.
Still Astor?
Yeah.
The reason I mentioned Hiaasen, he was reporting with the Miami Herald when you were there.
Yeah, he was an extraordinarily good writer.
Yep.
And he was an extraordinarily good reporter, but he was an extraordinarily good writer. He actually worked for me when I went through a short period of editing there as a city editor at the Broward Bureau. I sent Carl out to find out what they did with the horse manure at Gulfstream Racetrack out there. And Carl came back, and he's been eating out on that story now for 50 years, I think. It turns out that if you've eaten Campbell's soup, you probably Campbell's mushroom soup, you probably know what happens to all that horse manure.
Really?
It's like yeah.
Well, the other reason I mentioned Hiaasen is his novels are seem to be feeding off just the incredible wackiness he sees in South Florida.
Well, that's a crazy state.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that is kind of our official crazy state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're wacko down in Texas, and God only knows what they are in California, but Florida, it's hard to match. I mean, you know, people getting eaten by alligators and golf greens and stuff like that. It's like...
Well, what scenario can you build to get Lucas to Miami? You got him to Vegas in this book.
Oh, yeah. It's just another fugitive kind of thing.
Okay.
It'll be some kind of something coming out of Washington, D.C., because I want to see an art exhibit there and then going down to Miami and tracking down some crazy killer.
Well, can you remember at least three books back, or are you that ancient?
I'm pretty old.
Well, what was the book? Had to be Extreme Prey or Golden Prey, maybe, where Lucas is in Washington, D.C., tracking down the murderous senator from Minnesota.
Extreme Prey. Because she's an extreme...
What a bad woman.
Yeah.
What a bad woman.
Yeah, she's bad. Yeah. But she's not Amy Klobuchar. She's not Amy Klobuchar.
All right.
Doesn't even resemble Amy Klobuchar
I wasn't even associating Amy Klobuchar with her. What's her name? I can't remember.
I just wanted to see if your head would blow up when I mentioned the name.
No. You know, this is the toughest show of the week I put together because we try to be positive on Positive Thursdays.
Really?
And it's very positive to have you here. And what do you make of the fact that there are now 20 Democratic candidates running for office? 20.
Well, 17 of them scare me.
Right.
And
all 20 should, but I'll give you 17.
No, but I mean, the reason the 17 scare me is that I'm not a large fan of Donald Trump, to be honest with you.
Well, that's understandable.
I mean, I think he's a nutcase
and
a criminal.
Yeah, yeah.
But, okay, given that, I think that 17 of them could lose to Donald Trump. What's his face? The guy from Vermont.
Bernie.
Bernie looks like somebody's crazy grandfather ought to be locked in the attic.
Right.
And then when you read his back history, you know, his son out of wedlock, he got evicted from a place for non-paying rent, and he went off to some other place, and you start to look at his whole history, he's a nutcase socialist.
Right.
Right. So what can I say?
I've gotten to the point where I think 17 of them could do more damage to the country than Trump.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I think Trump is. You know what the country desperately needs, and you'll hear it here first.
All right.
It needs a mainline Republican to win the primaries against Trump. Kick out all of those Tea Party people and get back to some kind of serious mainline Republican conservative. Serious group of people who know that global warming, for example, is taking place. They're already starting to lose housing values on the coast down in Florida because people believe their houses are going to be underwater in 30 years.
I personally don't, by the way, but okay.
Well, yeah. No, but well, then you're wrong because that's
I'm not arguing with you, John. I'm just explaining why you're wrong.
Okay, but the point is that if you had a really tough, serious Republican.
I couldn't agree more.
Who could beat Trump, then we'd have a chance of righting the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't go from Trump to Bernie.
I agree.
Two questions. My first is for Senator Sanders.
I couldn't hear the question.
Yeah, I didn't ask it yet, Bernie. You've been pretty vague in the past, but how exactly are you going to break up the big banks?
You mean a big bank breakup?
Yeah, a big bank breakup.
Yeah, break them up!
See? Boom, he's got the answer. That was
Can
Larry
I get back
David,
to Extreme Prey? Because my mind is still tracking.
You know, the thing is that's right. That's exactly right.
Just break them up?
Yeah, just break them up. You know, just get a big hammer and bust them up. It's like,
John, Extreme Prey.
I can rant about all of the politics for here for 2 hours. I could come in here and
You're
do a two-hour show in which
here.
I did nothing at Scream. Yeah. And the fact is that when I mess up my hair and put on my glasses, I look exactly like Bernie.
Yes, you do.
I was going to say,
when I
went out there, I thought Bernie Sanders may be on the
I want to get back to Extreme Prey. One of the defining characteristics of, and it's improbable, there's two weird things about Lucas Davenport. One, that he's independently wealthy and has never needed a paycheck from any of these law agencies.
Right.
And two, he's a clothes horse.
Yes.
And you're not.
No.
Well, in Extreme Prey, there's a wonderful scene where he goes into this very nondescript shop and has them make him a suit and shoes and the whole deal. And I would imagine that was based on a real place in Washington, D.C.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Where does that fascination come from with his affection for such clothing and expensive clothing?
Well, when I was first engineering him as a character, I needed some of these odd... characteristics, so that's just one I happen to pick out. I often, you know, I dress the way you do. We both look like rag bags. I mean, you know,
I'm not that. I don't think it's a rag bag.
Joe's checking his attire right now.
I'm looking
now
at myself
speak,
right
yeah.
now. I don't think it's that bad.
No, it's that bad.
All right.
Check the picture on social media, folks.
Yeah, you are wearing some kind of a Twin Cities Pioneer Press jacket.
Yeah. It's like what a homer. Yeah.
Which doesn't fit, by the way.
What do you mean it doesn't fit?
So
what the hell are you talking about?
He bought one with a belly in him, okay?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So at any rate. I did that, and one of the other reasons was because I was pretty interested in fashion at the time. Not for me, for getting dressed up, but I liked kind of the psychological effect that fashion has. I'm fascinated by some of the things that go on in the fashion industry. I mean, how do you sell BS for your entire life?
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later say some other kind of BS is better. And that whole process is pretty fascinating, I think.
Let me tell you something. You also have him as a former U of M hockey player.
Yes.
Okay, when you engineered him, before you wrote Rules of Prey, the very first one,
right?
You did engineer the character.
Yes.
He didn't evolve in terms of it. From the get-go, he was rich. He loved clothing. He was a former hockey player. He had his way with women. Did you do the same with Virgil Flowers? Did you engineer him?
Of course. I mean, none of these are done by mistake or by accident.
No, I don't mean they're done by mistake. I guess what I'm learning, just from my own personal information, is that you didn't go into it and say, I think I'm going to write a thriller here about Rules of Prey. You created the character and then adhered to that characterization as the book developed.
Yeah, but it wasn't the first thriller that I wrote. The first thriller that I wrote was a kid book, and Kid
yep.
did evolve. And mm-hmm. and about the Rules of Prey would have been the second or third book that I wrote that was published. And I wrote a couple before that weren't published that were sucked.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was an evolution there. You just didn't see it in Davenport. Davenport started out as kind of a fully realized character because I'd kind of tried out different things in these other books.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able just to kind of jump into the – actually, what happened was I wrote the – I got $15,000 for my first two books, $15,000 a piece. And Esther said – this is a one-minute conversation. She said, you know, you could make a lot of money at this, but what you've got to do is you got to write longer books with more evolutions in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all she said. And that's what I did.
Esther, you're talking about a woman named Esther Newberger.
Right. And Esther Newberger in New York, she's my agent. But she gave that to me in 1 minute and said, go do that.
Mm-hmm.
And for about, I wrote the first Rules of Prey in about 4 months. And, you know, Larry Millette, who's one of the guys who worked at the paper with
mm-hmm.
us, said he would see me wandering around the skyways and I wouldn't recognize people because I was working that through my head so hard.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't see anything, and I was taking what we call in the newspaper business, we call undertime, which
mm-hmm.
is that's when you don't work but you still get paid.
Right.
And
I wouldn't know that. I've never experienced that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You do kind of keep your nose to the grindstone, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But when you were writing Rules, that was in your basement in Cottage Grove, right?
Yep. And I had my memory store was for the computer was a tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
Just making audio notes to
no, literally, you'd plug your tape recorder into the computer, and that would be your hard drive.
Oh wow!
And then the tape would play back the stuff, and it was like
technology.
If the tape broke, your book was gone. You know, it's like
stressful.
That's right,
John. I want you. I don't know if you'll have a chance to get there, but you still have a place up in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Yes, I'll be up there in August.
Well, I want you to stop at a place called Grunhofer's Meat Market. In Hugo. They're on Highway 61.
Okay.
It's they're the brat capital of the world. They have more than 130 brat flavors.
But can you get a wiener?
You can get everything you want. They'll cut bacon the way you want it. They'll cut steaks the way you want it. They'll do anything you want. They got the sticks, the chicken sticks and beef sticks.
Today I had a chicken stick with blue cheese.
Well, where's that? I got to read you something.
It was fabulous. This guy's an old-fashioned. He's a throwback to the old-fashioned meat market. Spencer and his group are second to none, and they're right on Highway 61 in Hugo. And if you're looking for that rookie burger mix, I do believe it will be available. Call Spencer or go to their website.
Do you have it, Joe? Or
I do have it. Listen to this. I just got off the phone with Spencer Grunhofer. I live in Draper, Utah, and work at a community college that has not consumed the Kool-Aid yet. We still push back. Anyway, I called him a few hours ago to inquire about shipping some brats that you talk so much about. He said he'd check into it and call me back. Much to my delight, he called me back and informed me that the brother of one of his employees, who was also a Grunhofer, just happened to be flying to Sandy, Utah.
Don't tell me.
Sandy is a short 5-minute motorcycle ride from where I live. Spencer Grunhofer is sending 6 packages of brats with his relative for me to pick up. I can't wait to try them. Spencer told me that there was one condition. I needed to contact you and tell you the story. What great service. I'll keep you posted. Robert Beeler in Utah. That's the kind of place I'm talking about. I'm serious. When you're here next summer or this coming summer, you're on your way to Hayward, stop and load up, and you'll be the belle of your ball up there at your cabin.
All right, I'll do that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Say, tell me how Virgil got engineered.
Well, you know, like I was several books in. Well, you wrote one of the Virgil books with me, and so you
Mad
know
River.
You know some stuff about that.
And oddly enough, John, my friend that works at the airport, there was a lady coming in on an international flight. And she had Mad River, right? She was about halfway through it, and she loved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the thing is that when you decide you're going to sit down and do this, you've got to figure out who your character is going to be. And Virgil Flowers, there was actually a boat, a river boat up the Mississippi that was named after a guy named Flowers. And I thought that was a cool last name. His name was Rusty Flowers, Russell J. Flowers or something like that, there was a boat called Rusty Flowers. I thought Rusty Flowers was a cool name, but then I couldn't use it because it's already using a boat and a bunch of other stuff. So I started looking for a first name. I thought about Homer Flowers, but then it's not, you know, it's too country and Homer and Jethro and all that. So I came up with Virgil, and Virgil Flowers sounds kind of neat to me.
Oh, I think so.
And so... I had that, and then...
But you attached traits to him. Long hair, rock and roll T-shirts,
right,
cowboy boots.
Way laid back, you know.
Yep.
But when you really think about it, it's sort of Southwest Minnesota.
Yeah, that's true. But he, unlike Lucas, you know, he doesn't like gunplay, and he doesn't like the nasty stuff.
He doesn't carry his gun around with him very much. And the current book, he gets involved in some kind of nasty stuff, although he doesn't shoot anybody, but because he doesn't have a gun, for one thing. But he was just – I was trying to come up with a different character that I could kind of let the sense of humor out on. And so that's where he came from. And I wrote about him with 5 or 6 of my friends, and you're one of them.
Generous. It was very nice.
Well, it was fun to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really, really was.
Yeah.
It really was. That's Mad River is now 7 Virgil books ago already. Seven Virgil books ago.
Yeah, I know. You know why? Because we're old.
That's right.
I keep coming back to that, and I can't. I'm turning into a curmudgeon.
Nothing wrong with that.
I was driving down Cleveland, south of Ford Parkway yesterday, going back toward my hotel, and I noticed that the city of St. Paul, for some reason, it must have been years ago, paved two-thirds of the southbound lane, but didn't pave the whole thing.
Well.
And I'm a curmudgeon. I'm yelling at clouds. Why would you surface two-thirds of one lane so that two of your wheels, and they allow parking on the street, of course, two of your wheels are on this potholed
wreck
thing, and the other one is completely smooth on the other side when your other wheel is on.
Can you stay with us for a moment?
Yeah.
Or longer than a moment?
We'll talk more road construction.
We'll be back.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen of Garage Logic, it's time to gear up for Souchere's Author's Corner.
Oh, God. Our guest is John Camp. I suppose when you're doing a show in Phoenix or Miami or New York or wherever, you're always just referred to as John Sanford.
Yes.
But I think most people around here know you by both names.
Yep, I hope so.
Now, are you going to do a Virgil book and a Lucas book each year still?
No, I am going to... one book a year next year. I'm finishing a Virgil book now. I will write a Lucas book starting in June, and I will finish that next January. But next January, I will start another Lucas book, another Prey book, but it will have Virgil in it, almost as an equal partner with Lucas working on the same case. And I'll take a year to write that, so there won't be two books in 2020.
And you still enjoy this. Obviously, you must.
I enjoy some of it, but the pressure's getting a little bit too heavy. I mean, writing two books a year means I really have about a week off all year.
Isn't that something?
And I'm writing like 6 days a week, and so I only have like a day a week off, and I'm just getting tired of it. I'm not. It's not that I'm getting tired of it. I'm just getting tired. Mm-hmm. Period. You know. It's
like, what is your routine then? Do you do Post-it notes, or how do you get in that Virgil mode, or you know, whatever book you're writing?
I pull it directly out of the place where the sun don't shine. Mm-hmm. I do not really put up notes or any of that stuff.
Wow, God is good, huh?
Yeah.
But you're not writing 8 hours a day either.
No, I write about four. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's the thing is you're thinking about it all the time because you're always in trouble. Kind of if you write the way I do.
Are your books edited?
Yeah.
But they're edited for grammar.
Right. They're copy edited more than anything.
They're copy edited. You're not at the point where someone's calling you and saying, I don't like this paragraph in chapter 10.
Do we have time for me to tell a short story?
Yes.
A few years ago, I wrote a book that involved a guy who was an extremely ambitious politician.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was that he was using a lot of things that are going on in American culture to boost himself into the race for the presidency. And he was a rich guy who one of the things he did, for example, is he's rounding up Latinos who are coming across the border and holding them in kind of pens and stuff like that. And he was, really appealing to this whole populist impulse and stuff like that. I almost was 2/3 of the way through the book, and I sent it off to New York, and my editor said, you know, John, I really don't like this book as much as I hoped I would, which is a really bad sign at that point. And mm-hmm. so I rewrote the whole book because his bottom line was, this can't happen here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just did. I mean, everything that was in that book, it was like, I mean, you know, like I had state governments so desperate for money, for more money that they were allowing gambling and that they were legalizing marijuana and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
They said it can't happen here, and now here we are.
Well, you could do that. In other words, you could do that book today.
Well, now it's too late.
Well, yeah.
Now you look like an idiot. Before I would have looked like a wizard. You know? Now I look just some guy trying to riff on what's actually going on here.
Explain the KIDD series, KIDD, for listeners who are unfamiliar with the KIDD series, which was, I think, unfortunately, brief series.
Well, KIDD was a guy who did industrial espionage. Essentially, mm-hmm. he's a computer genius and former wrestler at the University of Minnesota, which is you have to be a pretty good wrestler to be at the University of Minnesota. Not quite as good as you'd have to be at the University of Iowa, but sort of over that.
Right? Well, you say that because you went to Iowa.
Yes, yeah. And wrestling was our sport.
Right, right.
So at any rate, KIDD was a former wrestler, but a computer genius, but he essentially hacked stuff. He was an early hacker, and that's one of the reasons that I stopped doing it was because hacking sort of went out of fashion, and mm-hmm. it became to be a bunch of weird kids down their basements with big gulps and Cheetos and right. and greasy fingers and wrecking things. And that's not what KIDD did. He did industrial espionage for money. And he is also a painter, and he is currently the problem is that your characters age even without you trying. And I mentioned in like the first book that KIDD was an officer in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Vietnam ended 45 years ago,
right.
and he was an officer, so that would make him in his 70s at least.
Right.
Out of college, graduated, and all that kind of stuff before he began. So it's hard to keep a guy like that who you've nailed down as a romantic hero.
Right.
Now, if you look far enough back in the Robert Parker Spencer series, you find out that Spencer was a soldier in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make him in his 90s, and
right.
he's still boxing with,
right.
And,
doesn't
and
make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense anymore. So those people actually age. I was talking the other night about in the first Rules of Prey book, Lucas hurries with a friend of his, Del Capslock, to a phone booth. When was the last time you saw a phone booth?
Isn't that something?
There are adults who haven't seen a phone booth
That's
in
right.
their life.
That's right.
And there are adults who probably have never seen a phone book.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't talk about that anymore. It's like no more phone books, no more phone booths.
was Virgil's age is not a problem because I don't think you've ever established it.
Well, and that's what I've done with Davenport.
Right.
Davenport and I started out the same age of 42 or 45 or something like that. Now I'm 75 and Davenport's 52.
Yeah.
You know, so
he doesn't age. Does he?
He doesn't age. Well, he ages slowly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He doesn't have to age.
Yeah.
He can be whatever you want him to be.
But he did try to find a quarter of putting a phone booth, you know, in 1989.
I'll tell you guys a story. In 1989, that's when you were writing Rules of Prey.
Right.
And another affectation that Lucas had, okay, the clothing, a hockey player, independent, wealthy from having invented some computer games with a nun friend of his.
Right.
Right. But the fourth affectation was he had a Porsche.
Yeah.
And so I'm in 1989, I'm in Augusta, Georgia, covering the Masters. Mm-hmm. Nick Faldo won that year. And I get a call from, and this would have been way pre-cell phone. You found, you must have called my home, got the hotel where I was at, called the hotel, and my phone in my room rings, and it's John saying, "Where is the engine in a Porsche, front or back?" Do you remember that? Because you like, apparently Lucas put his hand on it or something, and it was warm, and you wanted to make sure it was you had the engine at the right end of the car.
Well, you know, the thing is that at that time I had no money for research. And I'd never – I mean, I was a newspaper guy. I didn't have a Porsche.
Right,
you know,
right.
I had no idea about this kind of stuff, but I knew Joe would know. But the thing is, he didn't have enough money for it either.
I didn't have enough money either.
He read about it.
Yeah. But he would read that kind of stuff. But the thing is that we were talking about bad research in my early books because I didn't have any money to do research mm-hmm. with. And so in the very first kid book, I have him just sitting. He's the end of the book is going to be in Vegas again. He's sitting in Flagstaff, Arizona, in January, sweating like a dog, and somebody calls me up after the book is published and say, "You know, Flagstaff, Arizona has a ski area there. It snows like crazy in the middle of the winter." And I had him, the air conditioning wasn't working in January and stuff like that. It's still being published, you know. It's still out there. Like that.
Why change it now?
Yeah. Did you have a good crowd at Once Upon a Crime?
I did, yeah. And a friendly one. And you know, I'm hoping for the same in the next two stops I make here.
Well, you've been really loyal to that store, haven't you?
Well, they were loyal to me.
Well, that's what I meant. I guess you have a nice relationship.
I went to a store in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for Rules of Prey.
Right.
Not a single person showed up.
Yep.
And the bookstore had done nothing to advertise it. They just gave me a table, set me back at the stacks of books with about three Rules of Prey in front of me and said, you know, sell these books. And nobody came. Nobody bought a book. About a half an hour later, I told the guy I was leaving. And he said, yeah, you might as well.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, really? Yeah. When's the next time you think you'll be coming through town to go up to your place in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I'll be here in August. I'll be back here in October. I come here four or five, six times a year.
All right, so we'll see each other this summer.
Yeah, I hope so. I'd like to actually play a round of golf with you and Denny.
Yeah, we will. We'll do it for sure.
So,
all right, thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
And we're going to be back in just a moment.
Gear up for Souchere's Author's Corner. Sit right down for Author's Corner. Let's all have some fun. Listen up to Souchere, because before you know it, it's done. Author's Corner with Joe Souchere. Just
is
the
he
way
gone?
You want it.
John had to run.
That, you know, in fact, that last segment, it was summarized in this.
Author's Corner with Joe Souchere. Just the way you want it.
That's the way I wanted it.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving it to me the way I wanted it.
Doesn't mean a thing.
Right.
Say one size rarely fits anyone. That's why you need to explore your insurance needs. That's why Federated Mutual Insurance Company tailors the insurance programs exclusively to your business. They offer property and casualty, life, disability, income insurance. Their marketing representatives are the best in this business. They get to know you, the owner, and how your business works. And that allows them to customize the coverage you need. They'll take care of your driving needs with auto liability. They'll take care of your data needs with compromised coverage. Your business is unique. You need an insurance carrier who treats it that way. Get in touch with a Federated Insurance Marketing Representative to see how their second-to-none service can help your business thrive. Because at Federated, it's their business to protect yours. Well, John was a wonderful Positive Thursday guest, isn't he?
Except for the time Rookie tried to drop the Let Us Pray line on.
Yeah, he's heard that before.
Yeah, he didn't really like that.
All right, we're ready for the Reavers Challenge
to me. Oh, yes. That's right.
On Positive Thursday, you boys are tasked with presenting me some audio that you're really pretty well convinced will not be allowed or will not be able to be turned positive by me.
And it couldn't have fallen on a better day than today for me personally. Positive Thursday, because I'm gonna be tasked with challenging the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this morning, former Vice President Joe Biden formally joined the crowded Democratic presidential contest, declaring the soul of the nation at stake if President Donald Trump wins re-election. In a video posted on Twitter, Biden focused on the 2017 deadly clash between white supremacists and the counter protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia. Here is a little snippet of Uncle Joe. Right.
Human history. We know.
He talks funny.
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Okay, the audio is not
there. Can I give you the positive on Biden?
Hold on. Let me just.
You already have it figured out. He hasn't even played it.
There was a quote. He says, "We are in a battle for the soul of this nation," Biden said. Mm-hmm. "If we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are, and I cannot stand by and watch that happen." The 76-year-old Biden becomes an instant frontrunner alongside Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is leading many polls and has proved to be a successful fundraiser. Biden has legislative and international experience that is unmatched, blah, 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 blah.
It's too easy.
Too easy?
It's too easy.
No.
Biden's entry into the field makes it now 20 Democrats running. With each new person running, they become crazier and crazier and crazier, and they will easily be able to be seen as the complete chuckleheads that they all are. So the positive thing, I would say, more. Come on, let's get five or six more. Come on in. You're all nuts.
Well, even Mr. Sanford, John Camp, saying 17 of them go away.
17 of them. And John Zed pretends to be a liberal, but he's wealthy enough to pretend to be a liberal.
Yes.
And even he is saying 17 of them scare me.
Right. And the other
20 of them scare me.
Well, I don't know if this is a game changer. Everybody wants. Isn't it a little bit too late for Biden to?
I think it's a complete game changer.
Kevin in Sartell, Minnesota writes, "Just wondering if you could pay tribute to a great living American on Positive Thursday. The person is my dad. He peacefully passed away on Monday, April 22nd, at the age of 87. He was drafted and served overseas for the Korean War." Let me stop right there. Even though the man is passed, he's a great living American.
Yes, exactly.
He's got to be over the age of 50. He was married to the love of his life for 58 years. He was a caretaker for his mom and mother-in-law for years by taking care of their yard and any maintenance that was needed. Our mom was diagnosed with dementia about 3 years ago, so he turned into a caregiver. He took care of her until his death did not allow him to. He finally, and deservedly so, was having someone care for him for the last 2.5 weeks of his life after moving into a nursing home. He had many jobs throughout his early years, but then he landed a job Joe respects. He was a mail carrier. Through his 33 years of delivering mail, most of which he walked the whole route, he wasn't given a mail truck until later in his career. He walked between 10 to 12 miles a day with 20 to 30 pounds on his back, wow, never complaining about the weather, although he did enjoy the 100-degree days more than the 40 degrees below windshield days. He also drove a school bus and charter bus for 50 years. Not much this man did not do. I appreciate you considering this. Thank you, Kevin in Sartell, Minnesota. Did you give that to Reavers?
So I had a great email exchange with Kevin yesterday, mm-hmm, and I said, I'll print this off for Joe. I set it on your keyboard late, mm-hmm, yesterday. Then he got back to me. You better get your sound effects ready. Hey, Reavers, thank you so much. I'm going to send him a copy.
Did the guy not die?
Put some money in my scan bucket, so you better get your coin
just
scans
a minute,
ready.
Just
get
a minute,
your coin
just
scans
a
ready.
Minute. Kevin, don't tell me Dad didn't leave us yet.
No. We did, unfortunately.
Miraculous recovery? Oh, okay.
One crucial part.
Yep.
I forgot to give my dad's name.
That's true. I think I deserve the coins for not even recognizing that. What was Dad's
his
name?
His dad's name was Al Gross.
Al Gross.
Al Gross. So he had a son. You better throw some coins in the scan bucket for me. I forgot to include Dad's name.
Yeah. Mike writes, Joe, I'm a daily podcast listener. Love the show. My question is to the global warming and 10-year crowd. If you love the Earth so much, why is there no litter movement? Here is something they can start today and actually see progress. Litter is everywhere. Just look around. Plastic bottles and trash everywhere. Think about it. It would be more pleasing and no litter to run down the storm drains, flowing into the rivers and eventually the ocean. Less plastic in the ocean, saving the whales. If they really want to make a change, start a litter movement. When I was a young lad, the signs on the road said, do not litter, $1,000 fine. Now it's an adopt-a-highway sign. Litter all you want, someone else will pick it up. Good luck. What a great point.
That is a good point.
The adopt-a-highway has taken place of the mentality of don't litter in the first place.
Right. And so then they're paying to adopt the highway as opposed to the sign where it's a $1,000 fine to litter.
Well, along the same lines, frequent contributor and deep thinker Downing has a good point. Hmm. As you often note, you recycle. You believe in turning off the lights and saving energy in various ways. You are a conservationist. Many politically conservative people are. It's in our nature. Yet when it comes to environmental issues, we have a great divide between the left and the right. But the left says the right doesn't care about the environment because we don't support all of their programs. Why can't we agree? Money. To my mind, saving the earth and saving money should go hand in hand. Buy and use less stuff. Use less energy. Hang your clothes on the line instead of using the dryer. Turn off the lights. Fix stuff so you don't have to buy new. That's how conservatives save the earth. But liberals, they're all about spending money to save the earth. They want new, expensive electric cars and all kinds of other expensive stuff to replace the stuff they already have, making sure to dispose of the old property, of course. But most of all, they are all about saving the earth by growing the government and government regulations. Spend, spend, spend. In short, conservatives save the earth by saving money. That's a program we can buy into. It's a win-win. It's a positive way of approaching it. It's a plan you can stick with because you are rewarded for doing so. The more you stick with it, the more money you have. Liberals, on the other hand, save the earth by spending money. The trouble is, eventually you run out of money. Their way is, as they might say, not sustainable. Hmm. Isn't that a good point?
Very wise.
Good point. Yeah.
They want to save the earth by spending money.
Break them up.
Break them up. Break up those banks. Scott writes, I was listening to the April 23 and April 24 podcast this morning at work and had a thought on the topic of people that think they can affect climate change. I have worked in the highway and heavy construction industry for 37 years. During that time, I have been involved in moving a lot of earth. The largest single project I was involved with moved 175,000 cubic yards of material in 6 months. One of the largest projects in history was the construction of the Panama Canal. That project involved moving 250 million cubic yards of material over roughly 14 years in the late 1800s and early 1900s. An even larger and more recent project, albeit lesser known, is the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway. That project involved moving over 300 million cubic yards of material in a 12-year period starting in 1972. While both of these projects served to improve the human condition, there was and is no shortage of politicians puffing out their chests, however, over how great these accomplishments are. Shifting gears, consider the following information on the eruption of Mount St. Helens, gathered from the United States Geological website. When volcanoes erupt, the volume of material moved is measured in cubic kilometers instead of cubic yards. One cubic kilometer is about 1.308 billion cubic yards. That happens to be the volume of material moved during the eruption of Mount St. Helens, about 1.3 billion cubic yards, and most of that occurred in the first 14 seconds of the eruption. As far as volcanoes go, Mount St. Helens was a relatively small eruption. Mount Novarupta in Alaska erupted in 1912, moving over 15 cubic kilometers of material, and Mount Tambora in Indonesia erupted in 815, moving over 160 cubic kilometers of material, a lot of which was spewed into the atmosphere, causing global change in climate and weather for years. Comparing these side by side, Panama Canal, 250 million cubic yards in 14 years. Mount St. Helens, 1.3 billion cubic yards in 14 seconds. Nature wins. The cult leaders preaching climate change are doing so strictly for political reason. The cult followers have simply lost touch with nature. Otherwise, they would see that nature wins every time, and their Priuses and compact fluorescent light bulbs are just a fart in a hurricane. Should Yellowstone ever go, I will be sitting in my garage with the door up, facing west, my humidor of Cubans and a bottle of bullet rye whiskey on the table next to me, mm-hmm. and marvel at it all. Hmm. Scott, isn't that wonderful? In other words, look what a volcano can do.
In 14
I mean, this
seconds.
Guy's moved a lot of dirt in his life. Look what a volcano did in 14 seconds.
Yeah.
I'd hate to be riding a motorcycle when.
Why do you think of stuff like that?
When Yellowstone goes up, because you'd really be pelted. But if you had a good helmet on, maybe you'd be all right.
Ah,
get a hold
of
DennisKirk.com. They're a Minnesota based company. They have more than 160,000 products in stock. It doesn't make any difference what kind of bike you ride. These are the guaranteed best prices, fast same-day shipping, and satisfaction guarantee makes them the best. You buy that helmet or apparel item and it doesn't fit or you just don't like it, that's not a problem. DennisKirk.com will even pay the return shipping. And at DennisKirk.com, order today, order by 8 o'clock today, you'll get it tomorrow.
Here's a man who spends hours in hardware stores sifting through the nuts and bolts of life, Joe Souchere.
Who hits the post?
Nice. Nice work, brah.
Is this Dylan?
No, this is Stooge.
This is Stooge?
Yeah.
One last positive Thursday item.
Yep.
A 26-year-old fellow who works for a towing and recovery service in Florida. Was driving the other night, Wednesday night. He saw flashing lights.
Mm-hmm.
He happened to be driving his tow truck. He said, I've driven by this site 1,000 times, but something didn't feel right, so I turned around, he said. And there he found a 77-year-old woman trapped in her vehicle that had plunged headfirst into the bank of a creek. The driver had reportedly veered off the road after an apparent mishap with her medication. Without a cell phone and unable to open the door, she turned on her hazard lights, played gospel music, and prayed that the Lord would send someone. And her answer to her prayer came in the form of this fellow, who also happens to be a volunteer firefighter. He knew what to do and immediately called for help. And she's fine. He's been a volunteer firefighter in Baker County for 6 years. And he's engaged and the father of a 2-year-old daughter. He spoke to the woman briefly. And his company then towed her vehicle for free. What was his name? Positive Thursday.
Is this a quiz? Mike.
His real name.
Oh.
Christian Miracle.
Come on.
I'm not kidding.
Come on. What are you saying?
I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you.
The Miracle guy.
His name is Christian Miracle.
Does that get the foghorn?
Christian is a real name. Christian Miracle.
Wasn't like if it was Miracle Christian. Yeah, right. Then Miracle would be.
No, that's
that was very, very positive, Joe.
Thank you. I haven't heard from you all day, Cheryl. You haven't been
it's
around.
It's not easy being the mayor, is it, Joe?
No. I work with cheeseheads and chuckleheads.
You
and
know, you
doorknobs.
You really got bailed out today by Camp being here. I don't think you could have done a whole show of positive
news. Two stories
you
had to judge on?
You got bailed out.
Let's call it in Happy Thursday.
Right.
Please. This is the hardest show of the week to prepare. There's not a lot of positivity out
there.
Okay.
Yeah. Say, don't forget Mother's Day and Molar goes together. Get her something that lasts longer than a brunch. Come on. RF Molar Jeweler, 50th and France in Edina, Ford in Cleveland and St. Paul, Gavaday Common. In Minneapolis and online at rfmoeller.com. Looks like tomorrow, then, we can get back to the same old dirt, huh? Tomorrow, yeah. We have presidential candidate James Pepion, former Minnesotan, now in Texas.
Yeah.
He's a Republican running for the president, and he's legit and serious, and he thinks he's got the answer.
From Texas?
Mm-hmm.
Will you wear your cowboy outfit?
Cheryl is asking you a question. I think that's very positive.
Joe, tell those two children to please stop blurting on the air.
That's right. Mm. You know how serious this guy is, James Pepe?
How serious is he?
He said, do you want me to come up there for the interview?
Oh, wow.
From Texas.
Come on up.
I said, that'll be unnecessary.
Right.
Now, but you know what he thinks is? That's the power of the Garage Logic podcast.
See? Mm-hmm. Now, he's from here, been a GL fan forever.
Yes. Yeah, we'll learn all that from him. He's cool. Down in Texas, businessman, and we'll learn more. And he believes he has the roadmap to victory. He believes he has this figured out as a Republican.
We'll listen to him.
As a Republican candidate. James Pepe, presidential candidate on tomorrow. None of us know what we're in for, but it might be enlightening. It might be enlightening.
You got yeehaw, yippee-ki-yay.
I don't know that he's that kind of Texan.
Okay. We'll find out, I guess.
You just from picture here. Everybody like that lives
in from Texas. You got boots and you got a hat on and you need a spittoon.
He's not from Harlingen.
Oh, I wonder if Rick knows him.
Rick from Harlingen.
Rick from Harlingen. Yeah. I wonder if Rick is a 12-month resident of Harlingen or if he's come home to a place up north.
That's next time we talk to him, we'll have to ask him.
Okay, that sounds like a plan.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks to John Camp, author John Sanford. The new book is Neon Prey. He'll be in Edina Barnes & Noble tonight and the Roseville Barnes & Noble tomorrow night, April 26th.
And your mock draft. Are we going to do a mock draft?
Yeah, what are we doing for the draft tonight?
I don't do any draft talk.
Take number six alignment. Let's have
no
a quarterback.
No draft talk.
Huh? You no, going out to the big party?
Me.
Come on, let's get out there. All right, if you are catching up on some of your podcasts, you know what you can do? You just go to our website, garagelogic.com. If you're a new podcast listener, thank you. I ask you to patronize all of our advertisers. And please rate us on Apple iTunes, good, bad, or indifferent.
Good only?
Good only? Oh, we can take it. Positive Thursday signing off. It's Garage Logic podcast version. Check out all the info at garagelogic.com.